Welcome to this Forthright Radio for August 10th, 2019. I'm Joy LeClaire. Our guest today on Forthright Radio is John Tolliver, and we'll be discussing his latest book, Grinnell, America's Environmental Pioneer and His Restless Drive to Save the West, published by LiveRight, a division of W.W. Norton. George Bird Grinnell is largely lost to conservation history, and John Tolliver has done us all a tremendous service in researching and writing so engagingly about him. John Tolliver is the author of 6 earlier books, including All the Great Prizes, The Life of John Hay from Lincoln to Roosevelt, In a Far Country, The True Story of a Mission, a Marriage, a Murder, and the Remarkable Reindeer Rescue of 1898, and Charles M. Russell, The Life and Legend of America's Cowboy Artist. By way of introduction, we begin today's Forthright Radio with an excerpt from his reading at the Country Bookshelf in Bozeman, Montana, on July 24th, 2019.
My goal, my purpose in the few events I've had around Montana in the last few weeks is to reintroduce Montana to this extraordinary man, George Bird Grinnell, who has been sort of shuffled off to the side of history for too long. And my real ambition is to reawaken Montana's interest in Grinnell, and then hopefully we can go from there, and maybe the rest of the world and the rest of the country will wake up to him also. He spent parts of 50 years from his first visit to Montana in 1874 to his last visit in the late 20s in Montana. And he was an adventurer. He came out to Yellowstone for the first time in 1875. But then he became a real creature of habit despite his adventurousness. And he came back to the same places over and over again. Yellowstone and to what he called the Walden Lakes, or the crown of the continent, which eventually, through his efforts, became Glacier National Park. He became dedicated to recording the history, the culture of Native American tribes, particularly the Blackfeet and the Northern Cheyenne, and advocating for their well-being. I argue that Montana would be a vastly different place if it had not been for George Bird Grinnell's presence here. It really is a story of evolution and extinction for Grinnell. He grew up in New York. His father was a merchant banker and broker. He went to Yale, graduated in 1870, didn't want to go to work for his father on Wall Street. And so he accepted an opportunity from one of his professors, the great paleontologist Othniel Marsh, to go west and dig dinosaur bones in the American prairie in the summer of 1870. What was happening then? Marsh had been to Europe, and this was 10 years after Darwin had written On the Origin of the Species. Marsh came back from Europe with Darwin really as his manual in his back pocket. In 1869, the Transcontinental Railroad was completed. And so for the first time, you could go back and forth across the United States in some comfort and with some rapidity. And Marsh took these dozen Yale students, and they got on a train, and they went out and got off in the middle of Nebraska. And it was one of the great dinosaur digs of all time. They started loading crates onto trains of the very first North American pterodactyl found, the Eohippus. It was fabulous. But while they were on that summer on the trip, Grinnell was converted. He saw the West that he'd romanticized for so long from reading James Fenimore Cooper and people like that. And he learned an object lesson in extinction right there with the dinosaurs, and then something more. There was another extinction going on right in front of his eyes. He saw that the buffalo already in 1869 were dwindling and diminishing. And what was the next step when the buffalo went? Well, the Native Americans were being harassed and decimated and forced onto reservations. So there was this cascade of extinction that was very graphic and very vivid in his mind. And that made an impression. Here was a young man who had grown up on the Upper West Side of New York when it was still rural, on the estate of John James Audubon. So Audubon's naturalism and his view of the world and his appreciation of American nature had really imprinted in Grinnell. So when he got back to New York as a 20-year-old, he, even more than ever, did not want to be a Wall Street banker. And he went to work for his professor at Yale, and then he eventually moved to New York, and he and his father bought a publication called Forest and Stream, a gentleman sportsman's magazine, which Grinnell very rapidly turned into an organ for the conservation movement. What was the conservation movement in 1880? Well, it was part of the progressive movement. Progressivism was a reform movement. We use the term today. It's much more loaded politically. Back then, progressivism was people of good intentions and of means and affluence who thought, well, we need to tackle some of these pressing problems of modernization, of the new age in America, of urbanization, of galloping immigration, corruption in government, the monopolies, the graft, and things like that. And that was the progressive movement. Teddy Roosevelt and his generation called themselves progressive. So Grinnell was very much informed and influenced and surrounded by progressivenesses. And what he did was he attached his concern for the wild and his worries about extinction, what was happening to native species, to Native Americans, to progressivism. And he said, well, look, we've got to be active and do something about this. People will say conservation began with someone like Thoreau or Charles Perkins March, who wrote his great book Man and Nature in the 1860s, or John Muir. But in my view, all these men were sort of philosophers. They walked the walk, but they didn't really put their shoulder to the wheel and create policy. Grinnell was the first person to do that through his publications, through his connections, through his own wherewithal, decided that conservation was something we could do through government and through advocacy in organizations such as the Boone and Crockett Club, which he and Roosevelt founded in one December night in 1887, or the Audubon Society, which sprang out of Grinnell's Forest and Stream magazine.
Welcome to Forthright Radio, John Tolliver. Your book, Grinnell, America's Environmental Pioneer and His Restless Drive to Save the West, has just been published. What possessed you to spend the amount of time you must have spent to learn about George Bird Grinnell?
Well, it's funny. He's been stalking me, this man, Grinnell, on and off for more than 20 years. I've written several other books where he has sort of crept up to the edge of the campfire, if you will. I live in Montana half the year. Grinnell spent nearly 50 years of his life. He was a New Yorker, but he spent nearly 50 years of his life going back and forth to Montana, initially as just to hunt and to climb mountains. But then he realized that the beauty of the place and he felt a great attachment to the Native Americans here. And he committed himself to being more than just an interloper and an adventurer, to caring about protecting and advocating on behalf of the environment here and the Native people. So I've done the same thing for the last 40 plus years, come back and forth to Montana from my home in Texas. Seems like a friendship that was ready to be forged between me and Grinnell.
Well, I have to confess, I had never heard of him before, and I learned a great deal from your book, by the way. It seems to me that he was uniquely placed to be just the right person at the right time in the right places. He had an extraordinary life. He began by living in the wilds of Manhattan at that time, proximate to the Audubon family. Talk about that.
Grinnell was the son of an affluent patrician, old New England family, and his father bought the estate of John James Audubon in the Upper West Side of New York when it was still rural. So when Grinnell first started going west, which he did after graduating from Yale in 1870, and started seeing what the rapid changes that were going on in the West, he had a romantic notion of the American West, as we all did, but he also was imbued with the Audubon's sense of nature and that there was something there that needed to be protected and preserved. He did have a unique vantage point because it's one thing to care about the environment and wish it would not be ruined, but to make the change and to protect the environment, you had to be able to dig in and form policy. Grinnell was very well connected in the East through a journal he edited called Forest and Stream. Started as a gentleman's sportsman's magazine and turned into an organ for the nascent American conservation movement. And he knew all the people in power in New York, and he could then actually form the policy and actually pass some of the laws that would become the foundation of our environmental movement today.
Well, one of the ways in which he was uniquely placed, as you mentioned, he went to Yale. Upon graduation, he participated in an expedition of fossil digging that unearthed unknown species. Talk a bit about that.
Well, haven't we all kind of wished for something like that? You graduate from college and you've got to join the real world. In his case, it was go to work on Wall Street for his father, which he wasn't too excited about. And then all of a sudden, one of the professors at your college says, hey, wait, you don't have to do that. I'm taking a dozen or so of your fellow students and we're going to get on the train. This was in the summer of 1870, the Transcontinental Railroad having been completed only a year before. Said, we're going to get on the train. We're going to go out into the middle of the country, this part of the nation that you've read about as a little boy through James Fenimore Cooper and all these wonderful adventure stories. We're going to get off the train. Buffalo Bill is going to be our scout. We're going to have Indians along to guide us. We're going to have the U.S. cavalry take us out into the great American heartland. We're going to dig up dinosaur bones all summer. That was something that Grinnell thought would be grand fun, and it changed his life, and it also changed the American West permanently.
How did it change his life?
Well, they were going out to dig up dinosaur bones, so there's thinking about evolution and extinction. Darwin's Origin of the Species was 10 years old. That was essentially their manual as they went digging bones in the North American continent. Yet there was another evolution and extinction going on right in front of his young eyes. The buffalo were already dwindling and headed towards extinction. That was easy enough to project. In another 15 years, there would be fewer than 1,000 buffalo in North America, down from some 30 to 40 million, say 20 years before. And then what followed on the heels of that, of course, was the threat to the Native American cultures. Their extinction was quite possible as they were being harassed, killed, forced onto reservations. So this lesson in evolution and extinction was imprinted on Grinnell, and he took that back east with him and spent the next 50 years of his life as a conservationist, wanting to preserve the West that he first saw and to protect the wild spaces and the wild species as best he could.
Now, you say it was easy enough to detect. Was it really? One of the things that I really love about your book, Grinnell, is how it resonates with our current era in terms of vision, being able to see what is happening in the environment, for example, and how best to deal with what is happening. So he impresses me throughout the book as a man of incredible vision. And certainly we need that in our current era. So among his contemporaries, how common was it to realize the extinction that was happening?
Well, he was a very practical fellow. So the clock that he heard ticking was a clock that was already ticking in the East. He is credited as the father of American conservation, the conservation movement. And what that really meant was he took concern for the environment and concern for our open lands and native species and connected it to the progressive movement. The progressive movement was going full steam in the East, and that was a group of like-minded people who were concerned about the rapid modernization and corruption and the problems of the cities overflowing and with tenements and what to do with immigration and monopoly and all these sort of things. And so there was this spirit in the East, at least, that good people needed to put their shoulder to the wheel and try to address these problems as we gallop toward the 20th century. Grinnell had that same fervor, but he brought the conservation movement into that sort of theater of concern. That's my contention anyway. So he had the tools of progressivism and he turned them onto conservation.
We are speaking with John Tulliver about his latest book, Grinnell, America's Environmental Pioneer and His Restless Drive to Save the West.
I want to focus eventually on the aspects of his life in ethnology. He did us all a tremendous service in documenting the words of Pawnee elders and Blackfoot elders and Cheyenne elders mm-hmm. in particular. But before we get there, as I was saying, he's in the right place at the right time. He actually ended up on an expedition with George Armstrong Custer.
Yeah.
Let's talk about his relationship with George Armstrong Custer for starters.
All right, we'll set the stage. So Grinnell went, first time he went west, first time he'd been really west of the Hudson River was in 1870 with his fellow Yale students. He was invited back and he wanted to go back immediately. He went back on a buffalo hunt in 1872. And in 1874, he was invited to be the naturalist on a U.S. Army reconnaissance into the Black Hills of Dakota Territory, which was led by George Armstrong Custer, Lieutenant Colonel. And anybody who knows all about Custer knows that what Custer really did was stick a stick into an anthill. The Black Hills were, by treaty, belonged to the Sioux. And Custer went in and brought along a couple of miners who dug up gold. The gold rush began, and the Black Hills were taken from the Native Americans. Grinnell saw Custer firsthand. He saw what he called a harum scarum fellow. Custer traveled with two packs of hunting hounds, and he was just this man full of bluster. And Grinnell has a sort of more proper Easterner, thought this guy was just too much. And he very, in his diaries very early on, he called Custer on his real outlandishness. So 2 years later, Grinnell was invited again to go out with Custer. He demurred. He had some family distractions. So if he'd accepted the invitation, he would have gone with Custer to Little Bighorn in 1876, and I would have written a much shorter book.
We're going to jump around. Your book is organized more or less chronologically, but I want to now jump ahead to the 50th anniversary of the battle that you just talked about. And you don't make much of this in your book, but the common lore was that it was, oh, poor Custer, what a hero, and these bloodthirsty savages, it wasn't fair, and all this kind of stuff. But one of Grinnell's achievements was actually chronicling people who had been at the battle and their versions of it. Share with our listeners some of what he learned.
Grinnell probably did start with that notion of that this was a tragedy, that it was a massacre, that Custer and the men who died at Little Bighorn were martyred, all that sort of stuff. But when Grinnell started spending time around Native Americans, including the Northern Cheyenne Indians in Montana, he saw their dignity. He admired their culture. He was concerned that they were going to be crushed by this juggernaut of American expansion. And he became very sympathetic, more so than most of his contemporaries. And he realized a couple of things. One, I need to help Native Americans adapt. He's guilty and rightfully guilty of a certain paternalism, but was always on the side of the Indians, starting very early on. The other piece of it is he realized, look, their history, their lore, their culture is being trampled and being forgotten. People are getting old every day and losing their traditions. And so he set out to record as much of this history as possible. So he walked the battlefields with Native Americans who had fought against Custer. And he was one of the very first guys to really recount what had occurred at Little Bighorn from the Indian point of view. This was fresh new stuff in his time, and he didn't waste a lot of time apologizing for or defending Custer either.
In addition to being fresh new stuff in his time, it's also really important history for our time to learn the lessons of history.
So Grinnell was called the father of American conservation, but if he had done nothing else than contribute to the history of Native Americans, of filling hundreds of pages of notebooks over 50 years of conversations he'd had and interviews he'd done sitting around campfires with Native Americans, often with a translator with them, gathering their stories. If he had done nothing else besides gather these stories, he would be immortalized today for his contribution as the benchmark Native American ethnologist of his time.
Along the way, he met some very interesting people, including the North brothers, Frank and Luther, who's nicknamed Lute North, and he had lifelong friendships with these men. Please tell us about them.
Grinnell had a great spectrum of friends. It's starting early on when he was a young student at Yale. He was a member of the Secret Society, Scroll and Key, and I think he just took that notion of a fraternity of mates on through life. And when he first went out west as a young man, early 20s, immediately after leaving the Yale campus, he made more and more friends. And what was interesting, he was a well-to-do, educated, sort of buttoned-up Easterner, but he made great friends with scouts, and the two North brothers were young men who had grown up on the Kansas prairie on the Pawnee Indian Reservation and learned the language. And so they were sort of Grinnell's escorts. These are sort of dreams come true. He wished that he could be like the North. They had ridden with the Indians. They had fought buffalo. They'd been in hand-to-hand combat with other Indian skirmishes. They'd been wounded. They'd survived. And Grinnell just thought this was his ticket to the real American adventurer. And they were drawn to him too, which is a compliment to Grinnell that this Easterner could come and fit in. One of the descriptions by one of the Westerners who first met Grinnell was they got off the train and they looked at him and said, "No tenderfoot he."
That in itself is remarkable right there.
There's this long tradition of not wanting to be the dude. You know, you don't want to be the tenderfoot. You want to, you know, we all first came out west. First thing we did was bought cowboy boots. So somebody think we were a cowboy or a cowboy hat, something like that. I guess Grinnell did some version of that.
Well, one way or another, he was accepted by these people in spite of class differences and educational differences and all sorts of differences.
Well, he was a tough guy. He was about 5'10", never weighed more than about 130 pounds. And he would come west after having sat in a New York office all winter long and get on a horse, pull a pack string, and climb up into the mountains of what eventually, due to his efforts, would become Glacier National Park, climb to the top of 10,000-foot peaks. It was pretty impressive. He was a scrappy guy.
We are speaking with John Tolliver about his latest book, Grinnell, America's Environmental Pioneer and His Restless Drive to Save the West.
I'm glad you brought up what he explored, and there's some reason to believe he was the first European to explore what would become Glacier National Park. Talk with us about that.
Well, when I began this book, I had this idea that I was going to write about a man who was getting, if you will, the last squeeze out of the toothpaste tube of Western exploration. It was the late 19th century. Every mountain had been climbed pretty much and everything had been named. The frontier had been famously determined close. And Grinnell thought he could get one last little dram of Western adventure. So he came into Montana, and in 1885, he arrived on the Blackfeet Reservation in northwestern Montana and went off on a pack trip up into the mountains of what would be the eastern slope of the Rocky Mountains, which is Glacier National Park. And he climbed up to many of the glaciers and started naming them, including famously Grinnell Glacier. And so he did, in a way, get that last squeeze out of the tube. But it went so much farther that then he realized, no, we need to protect these places. He'd seen what happened when Custer went into the Black Hills. He saw what was happening in Yellowstone National Park, where he went in 1875, the greed and commercialization that was threatening it. And he said, we've got to do these with other places. And that led, it took him another 30 plus years, but he created what is today Glacier National Park.
Well, let's go back to Yellowstone. That was the first national park, not just in the United States, but in the entire world. And one imagines that, you know, okay, you say it's a national park and then it's protected, but that's not actually what was going on, was it?
Well, the original Organic Act, the Organizing Act of Yellowstone, created in 1872, was a pleasuring ground for the public. It was the national park. It wasn't a national park. It was the national park. But what was a national park? You couldn't get to it very easily. The railroads were still 10 years away. And Grinnell, who came in to Yellowstone for the first time in 1875, had to ride down from the Missouri River. It was a several-week trip. He realized, well, we need to figure out what a national park's supposed to be. He saw it as a place where animals and wildlife could be protected and unharmed. And so he was very much part of the conversation and very much driving the conversation on what a national park could be. Yellowstone in 1875, yes, it on a big map, it had boundaries, but nobody had ever surveyed them. What I think is very interesting and what people forget about Yellowstone was they very quickly realized, he and some of the other government people, including people from the U.S. Geological Survey, realized that Yellowstone's boundaries were arbitrary, that the animals that lived there, particularly the elk and the bison, the endangered bison, migrated in and out of the park across what were the boundaries, and that Yellowstone needed to be expanded, needed to increase the boundaries. Grinnell was right at the forefront of trying to enlarge the boundaries of Yellowstone in what today would be called the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem. They never succeeded. There was always pushback from Congress because, like today, they wanted the commercial interests and mining interests said, no, you've got enough out there. They got Congress, almost snuck it through Congress, to create what was called a forest reserve around the perimeter of National Park, an area we would call today the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem. So in this creation of Yellowstone and trying to realize what a national park would be, they succeeded in creating the very first national forest. So we had the very first national park, and because of that, we soon had the National Forest Service.
So we've said that Yellowstone was the first national park, but it was preceded by Yosemite, right? That was a state park.
President Abraham Lincoln gave, I think by executive order, listeners can correct me on this, but gave what was the Mariposa Grove, the big sequoia trees, and Yosemite to the state of California. So it became a park, but it wasn't by congressional act a national park. So that technically, people in California, people in Yosemite say we were, but they weren't. It wasn't properly a national park until after Yellowstone.
Among the controversies that ensued, what you were talking about, forces, mining and commercial forces, there was a movement to actually dam the Snake River and the Beckler River of a southwestern portion of Yellowstone. for agricultural purposes in Idaho. And this was 1920. Our California listeners will immediately think of Yosemite and the Hetch Hetchy Dam. And in your book, you seem to draw a distinction between the two situations. I wonder if you could clarify what the distinctions are in your mind.
Well, we remember that the Hetch Hetchy was damming of the Tuolumne River to create a water supply for the city of San Francisco, which had been ravaged in the earthquake. And it had been a real showdown for the American conservation movement, a real test for the might of the American conservation interests. And the conservation lost and the dam was built. And John Muir was in the center of all this. And so it was a real tender spot in environmental history. It was a wound. And years went by, and Idaho farmers who live along the Snake River, which is to the southwest of Yellowstone National Park, came up with this idea of damming Lake Yellowstone, the lake in the middle of Yellowstone, and raising the level and then building a underground pipeline that would siphon water that normally would have flowed eastward into the Missouri River, into the Yellowstone River, and then the Missouri River, and draining it westward across the Continental Divide into the Snake River. Immediately, people started calling it a second Hetch Hetchy. Grinnell, by that point, having first visited Yellowstone in 1875, was now 70 years old and dug in. And by that point, he had quite a cohort of environmental groups, conservation groups, as they were called then, and said, we're going to fight this. Because if this is allowed to happen in Yellowstone, then other things can happen in Yellowstone, like cutting timber or mining. And then when it happens there, it will start to happen in other national parks. And we must stop it and fight it here. And they succeeded. The parallels today are just probably put the hair up on the back of your neck, because this whole idea that local interest, commercial interest can prevail over national public interest is something that we're talking about every day now.
We are speaking with John Tulliver about his latest book, Grinnell, America's Environmental Pioneer and His Restless Drive to Save the West.
Well, our California listeners will remember the salmon die-off in the Klamath River, I believe it was, where, again, it was Oregon potato growers at the headwaters who siphoned off water. They were allowed to do it by federal fiat, and the salmon just died, thousands of salmon. So these issues continue.
Well, what Grinnell was so prescient about was, he wrote about this quite often. He said, the greatest threats to our national parks come from those who live nearest to them. The other point he raised in trying to keep the commercial development, allowing mining or logging or damming in our national parks, was, and he made this point so well, that there was economic value to our national parks. They were engines for the economy. People coming there brought dollars. He, 100 years ago, was basically forecasting what the tourism dollar would do to parts of the country and how valuable national parks were as engines and legs under the economy of local regions. And the other thing he pointed out was that national parks provide something even a little more abstract for the public, and that they refreshed people. It gave them a reminder that there was another kind of, there was beauty. There were, when somebody went to a national park and climbed a mountain or walked down a trail or saw wildlife, it was refreshing. It was restorative. And that was an important part of our country's well-being. And I think he was very much ahead of his time in stating that.
Well, he lived that. Based on your book, I had the impression that it was his pretty much annual summer, fall excursions into the Western mountains that allowed him to do it. I mean, his pace was frenetic in terms of the output of his work. How many books did he write?
I wish I could
40-something.
Count them, but yeah, probably something like that. He edited a weekly publication called Forest and Stream, which most of which he wrote himself. He charged back and forth to Washington to lobby for this and that cause. He wrote sometimes several thousand words of correspondence a day. It seemed like there was 48 hours in every one of his days. And then in the summer, he would just shut his office door and leave it with one of his editors and hop on a train and race westward, climb mountains, interview scores of Indians. And he found that refreshing, restorative to do that. He'd come back smelling his clothes full of campfire smoke and ready to go back to work in his New York office. And I guess that's what we all should hope for.
Now, you mentioned John Muir. Let's compare John Muir's approach to conservation and George Grinnell's approach to conservation.
Well, I mean to be respectful towards John Muir, who I admire greatly. But John Muir, like somebody like Henry David Thoreau, was more of a symbol, a poster child. None of us could live the life of John Muir to sort of walk through the woods and sleep in the pine needles and climb a top of a mountain and sustain oneself just by the very breath one took of mountain air. Muir was a great example. His values were inspirational, but Muir never wrote any policy. He lent his name to good causes. It created the Sierra Club. He didn't roll up his sleeves and go and lobby to protect migratory birds or to create new national parks or new national parks. Grinnell was a practical man, and because he was an Eastern man and a connected man, he saw, look, we need to make concrete permanent changes. And so Muir will endure forever and be beloved forever, and Grinnell may be more forgotten, but I argue that Grinnell did more to enact the dreams and ideals of John Muir than almost anyone else.
Let's talk about his creativity in terms of tactics and strategies for accomplishing his goals in conservation. Am I correct that he founded what turned into the Audubon Society?
Grinnell founded the first Audubon Society, and let me explain. So he was the editor of the Sportsman's Magazine, which included a lot of bird hunters and a lot of gun owners. And what was going on in the 1880s in the U.S. was a fashion thing. It was sort of like the beaver hats 50 years earlier. It was a fashion trend for women to wear feathers in their hats. Every woman who stepped outside their door wore a hat, and they were adorned with feathers. And many of those feathers were from birds that were endangered, particularly the egret feather. In Florida, the rookeries were just wiped out. It was destroying dozens of species are threatening dozens of species of birds. So Grinnell started through his magazine, Forest and Stream, his hook and bullet hunter and fisherman magazine. He said, let's take up this cause of getting women not to wear feathers in their hats and limiting the commercial hunting of birds. And so he said, we'll call it the Audubon Society, and little groups around the country all sent in their nickels and signed up to become members, particularly among women. College girls formed groups, and it's sort of like not wearing fur. They would wear hats that didn't wear feathers, and they called them Audubonnets. And this all came out of Grinnell's editorials. It became so popular and so unwieldy that he couldn't manage it. So after a couple of years, it quieted down and died, and then sprang up about 10 years later as the National Association of Audubon Societies. But yeah, the original germ was Grinnell's.
I found it intriguing that he used that approach of making it uncool to... were there precedents for that? Are you aware of any? Or did he come up with that idea?
I am not aware of it. I'm
I'm thinking
about women wearing whalebone corsets. No, nobody tried to stop that. Nobody tried to, the fashion just changed that got men to quit wearing beaver hats. Maybe there was another easier material. But Grinnell published this little article. He sent a young man out onto 14th Street in New York who was a birder. He was a guy who liked to observe birds. And he stood out there all day. 14th Street was the busiest street in New York at the time. And he just counted bird species on women's hats. And they just published the list. I can't remember. There were just hundreds and hundreds of birds. And it was a grand political theater. And they ran that and said, look, this is what you're doing out there, ladies. This guy's name was Frank Chapman. I'm reading now from my book. Chapman's results were tabulated in Forest and Stream. Robin 4, Bluebird 3, Wilson's Blackcap Flycatcher 3, Waxwing 23, Golden Wing Woodpecker 21, Snow Bunting 15, Blue Jay 5, Scarlet Tanager 3, Baltimore Oriole 9. This was just a sampling of the 40 species he could identify positively. Many other feathers he could not name, but of 700 hats observed, 77% had feathers. This was the beginning of the Audubon Society, which is really one of the great conservation organizations in the world today.
Shaming did its job. Yes. By June, the Audubon Society boasted 10,000 members. By the end of the year, that number had nearly doubled, with more than 300 local chapters. And mind you, this is in the era before, well, I suppose the telephone was a newfangled thing, but getting word around is not what it is today. So I'm very impressed by the effectiveness of his tactics and strategies.
And using the pages of what was a gentleman's hunting and fishing magazine. You can't imagine that today with the outdoor life or something, starting the Sea Shepherds or something. It can't happen.
Well, we should say that after he ceased being the editor of Forest and Stream, it turned into Field and Stream.
Yes.
Which is
about 1920. Yeah, the names are confusing.
We are speaking with John Tulliver about his latest book, Grinnell, America's Environmental Pioneer and His Restless Drive to Save the West.
Now, that was not the end of the problems of bird decimation. And that brings up the issue that many of our listeners who have attempted themselves to work in conservation movements of dealing with difficult people. And I'm thinking of William Temple Hornaday, who had many good qualities, but he could be a very difficult fellow. This came up in the context of many years of working to try to protect migratory birds. Would you, first of all, talk about that effort and then how to dance around some of the personalities?
Well, by the turn of the century, I'm meaning the beginning of the 20th century, conservation, thanks to Grinnell, was getting to be a pretty big tent. There was a pretty diverse group of people, and there were diverse causes. People who wanted to save the bison, people who wanted to save songbirds. And one of them was a man named William Temple Hornaday, who started out as a taxidermist. He killed his share of animals, and he became the director of the First National Zoo in Washington, and ultimately became the director of the New York Zoological Society, which today we call the Bronx Zoo. He was like a drunkard who gave up drinking. He became a real purist, and Hornaday said, "We can't kill any birds, songbirds, migratory birds, game birds." He thought that all wildlife should be protected. Grinnell still had one foot as a sportsman, and he believed that as long as you controlled the amount of birds killed, as long as the birds weren't killed and animals weren't killed to be sold commercially in restaurants or for their hides, that hunting was still an honorable and a noble practice as long as it was done within reason. So along comes this real milestone in conservation movement in the U.S., which is I call the migratory bird issue. Conservation got to the point where the states all had various laws protecting bird hunting, their bag limits, the seasons you could hunt them, that sort of thing. But there were no federal legislation. Birds didn't know this. Many species of birds, ducks, for instance, started in Canada and ended up in Florida. They didn't recognize the state lines. They didn't know what the laws were state by state. Grinnell and several of his friends said, we need to pass a federal law that protects migratory birds. There was no precedent for this. There were interstate commerce laws for other kinds of trade. So they pushed very hard for federal legislation. Our friend Hornaday stepped up and said, look, we can't have any exceptions. You want to allow many of these birds still to be killed. I want to stop all of it. He stood up from inside the conservation circle, if you will, and was resistant to this. The trouble came from inside the tent as strongly as it came from outside the tent. And finally, they came up with a compromise. If the law would be included to regulate the killing of no killing of songbirds and no killing of what they called insectivorous birds, which were birds that ate bugs, because that got the agricultural interests on board because bugs ate crops. And they passed the Federal Migratory Bird Act. It took them 15 years to do it. And it was the very first federal legislation, I believe, that was conservation minded. And it's the precedent of the Endangered Species Act.
And it eventually involved Canada and one other country, I forget what one, for the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918. Another aspect of this that kind of made it more complicated was that both the Remington Corporation and the Winchester Corporation, along with smaller gun makers, proposed funding $125,000 over 5 years to the National Audubon Society. This really rubbed Mr. Hornaday the wrong way. And we have issues like this today where candidates, are they going to take fossil fuel money? How pure do they have to be? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, this is a delicious and astonishing story, and especially when we think of what's going on today. So Winchester and Remington, the biggest manufacturers of guns and ammunition, came to the National Association of Audubon Societies, the next generation from Grinnell's Audubon Society, and said, here's a pile of money. Do what you want with it, but we really believe that we have an interest in you protecting birds, because if all these birds are killed off and species become extinct, then we're not going to have anybody go out hunting. And so we're on your side. Now, Grinnell, having been a sportsman, was on the board of the National Association of Audubon Societies, voted aye, yes, let's pass this. And they did. And then it got out to the newspapers, this hue and cry is you've been bribed by the gun guys. They particularly, Hornaday came forward and said, well, these guys are all starting to make their automatic shotguns and pump shotguns were becoming popular, sort of like automatic weapons today. And so the public said, oh, no, this is making the Audubons look bad. So they had another meeting, reversed the vote. The gun interest immediately went and formed another group called the American Game Protective and Propagation Association. Grinnell was all for it. One of Grinnell's proteges led it. And this organization, this AGPPA, American Game Protective and Propagation Association, took the lead in passing this migratory game bird law. So we have in the 19-teens, the most important federal conservation law being passed with money from gun manufacturers. It just makes your head snap if trying to imagine how that would, anything like that could happen today. You imagine the NRA getting in bed with the Audubon Society or the Nature Conservancy or something.
Strange bedfellows.
Yeah.
after having kind of dumped on William Temple Hornaday, we should also include the information that he founded the American Bison Society and was a proponent of the Permanent Wildlife Fund as well. So he was a complicated man.
We all need stubborn purists around us. We need somebody to really carry the ideology forward. Sometimes it's just tough to go sit in a meeting with and get things done.
But it must also be said that his position at what we would consider the Bronx Zoo for having an exhibition of a Congolese pygmy person in the monkey house, and he didn't write The Passing of the Great Race. That was Madison Grant, I guess. But he was a proponent of eugenics.
So William Hornaday, yes, he created the Bronx Zoo. It became his fiefdom. And a lot of these conservationists, I wouldn't throw Grinnell right at the top of the heap here, they really had blind spots in a number of ways. One of course, of which they didn't care so much for the protection of predators, any animal that was higher than they on the food chain, bears, wolves, things like that. They didn't mind seeing them killed off. And they also had another blind spot, many of them. Grinnell, not so much because of his great sensitivity and sympathy for Native Americans, that there was a racial hierarchy. This was very much the thinking of the day. And Hornaday, this is a famous story, a great story of shameful moment in American history, where a pygmy who had been brought back to the U.S. from Africa to be on exhibit at the St. Louis World's Fair ended up living for several weeks in the monkey house at the Bronx Zoo, condoned by Hornaday. Now, Hornaday didn't lose his job over it, but it certainly was a black eye and a very dark time for him. And a number of other people in that group, including the secretary of Grinnell's organization, the Boone and Crockett Club, and the one of the lead men at the Bronx Zoo was a guy named Madison Grant, who was one of America's great conservationists, but he was also wrote a book called The Passing of the Great Race, which was really a central document in what became the eugenics movement and bioengineering to produce a better race, and believed in all of this racial hierarchy, malarkey. And so these guys who were leading conservation, they weren't perfect. And we remember some of the things they did were very regrettable.
John Tolliver, I very much regret that we are out of time. Do you want to take a moment for final words for our listeners?
The reason I undertook this biography of George Bird Grinnell was to put him back into the conversation about conservation, to remind people of his importance and his great contribution, but also to remind people that this cause has been going on for a long time. This fight for conservation has been going on for 100 years or more. And Grinnell was really the prototype of the American conservationist. He realized that he wasn't going to get things done right away, and he wasn't going to get everything done that he wanted to get done. But he set a great example, and many people rallied around him, and he spawned and sparked many great organizations and movements. And I want him to be inspiration for today. I want people to look at what he said. The things he was concerned about and the things he hoped for 100 years ago are the same things we care about today. So I guess I want this to be an inspirational message that let's just keep soldiering on as Grinnell did.
Amen. Thank you very much for joining us today on Forthright Radio, John Tolliver.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Our guest today on Forthright Radio has been John Tolliver. We've been discussing his latest book, Grinnell, America's Environmental Pioneer and His Restless Drive to Save the West, published by LiveRight, a division of W.W. Norton. And in my opinion, it merits consideration for the Pulitzer Prize. The views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of this station's staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors. This edition of Forthright Radio
has been a Beyond the Deep End production produced in Bozeman, Montana by Joy LeClaire for broadcast on Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman. KGVM is your community radio station. KGVM is entirely volunteer-run and, unlike other public radio stations, receives no governmental, university, or major corporate funding. So KGVM is entirely dependent on the generosity of our listeners to continue bringing you programs by, for, of, and about Gallatin Valley and beyond. You can join other generous listeners who put their money where their ears and minds are by going to the KGVM.org website and click on the gold support button at the top of the page. Together, we can continue to produce and broadcast programs such as this. And we do thank you for your support. Till next time, this is Joy LeClaire signing out for now.